Good morning. Thank you very much for the warm welcome to Central High School. I represent the plaintiffs in the Terranova case, Alex and Fred Terranova. And as has been indicated to you already, our case involves a student baseball player at Legacy High School in Brookfield, Colorado, who was injured on two occasions in March of 2011. The first of those injuries occurred when he was struck in the back of the head during a practice game by a pitch. The second one occurred a few weeks later when he was injured during what we contend is a very dangerous pickoff drill in which he was standing in the middle of three different pitchers on the mound, not wearing helmets, without protective screens, when there were pitches being thrown from multiple places around the infield at all three players standing on the mound, and he was struck in the back of the head yet again. It's also our contention that the coach acted willfully and wantonly by failing to assess and follow proper protocol for concussions that he had been trained on just 7 days prior to the first incident. And so the issues that you're going to be hearing me argue today involve our claims of willful and wanton conduct against both the coach and the administrators who've been named in the suit, as well as issues involving the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, which form the basis of our claim against the school district itself.
Thank you.
And Your Honors, with the system we have here today, am I able to still reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. As indicated before, my name is Kimberly Shutt, registration number 25947, appearing here today for Alex and Fred Terranova, the plaintiffs below. And I would note that Mr. Fred Terranova has also made the trip to Grand Junction and is in the audience for this event today. This case involves issues which have been at the forefront of both state and national news for several years recently. And that issue is concussive injuries to athletes. In fact, in Time magazine just this week, there was yet another story about three high school athletes who died within the last 10 days playing their respective sports, two of them from serious head injuries that were sustained during play. In this case, as you know, Alex Terranova was a baseball player at Legacy High School when he sustained not one, but two serious head injuries when he was struck in the back of the head by a baseball. Those are injuries which still plague him today. The claims, as were presented in the trial court, involve claims of willful and wanton conduct, as well as claims under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. And those claims, we contend, were erroneously dismissed by the trial court. We've raised three issues on appeal, and I will be addressing all three of those issues, although focusing primarily on the first two. I'll address the attorney fee issue only if there's sufficient time. With regard to the first issue, the dismissal of the willful and wanton claims against both the coach and the other individual administrators, we contend that the trial court clearly applied the wrong standard of review in deciding whether or not these claims should go forward. Our Supreme Court in City of Lakewood versus Brace very clearly discussed the nature of this determination that should be made. Because claims of willful and wanton conduct are specifically excluded from immunity under the CGIA, they are not to be reviewed under Rule 12b-1, which is what the trial court did here.
If I can interrupt you, Ms. Schiff, could you address, I do understand your argument. I think there is case law that says it's 12b-1 issue, but setting that aside, what difference does it make here? The judge basically said, taking your allegations as true, they fail as a matter of law. The judge effectively applied a 12b-5 standard, or it seems to me, push back. I mean, I don't understand what the distinction is in reality here.
I think there is a significant distinction. A distinction is that under 12b-5, you're to review the allegations and the like most favorable to the plaintiff and decide whether or not there's any inference of willful and wanton conduct that should go forward to be resolved by the jury. I think in City of Lakewood versus Brace, as well as decisions from other panels of this court, including the Gray versus University Hospital case, the Hendricks case, Peterson versus Arapahoe County Sheriff case, Davis versus Paulino. In each of those cases, the court applied a Rule 12b standard and looked at whether or not there was a sufficient inference of willful and wanton conduct, and stated that whether or not the conduct was willful and wanton itself was then an issue that was to be determined by the jury at trial. It involves weighing issues of the witness's credibility, it involves looking at disputed facts, and those are better left for the jury to determine, particularly given the factual nature of this inquiry.
But didn't the court do exactly that? Didn't the court say, I assume the truth of your allegations, if I give you all the inferences, I don't think you've stated a claim. Isn't that exactly what the court did?
No, the trial court never said it was weighing the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. It just said simply, I'm finding these claims are not willful and wanton as a matter of law as to how they've been alleged. I think there's an important distinction. I think if this court, on its own de novo review, looks at the 13 pages of specific detailed allegations spelled out in our complaint, in comparison to the allegations that a panel of this court found sufficiently alleged against the doctor in the Gray case, there's a very, that those cases are very much aligned, and if those case claims were alleged and allowed to go forward in Gray, they should likewise be allowed to go forward here. In fact, in the Peterson case and in the Davis case, those were allegations made by a pro se plaintiff, which were far more bare bones than what we have in our case. And those were allowed to proceed and recognizing the fact-based determination of a willful and wanton claim under circumstances far less detailed than here. And this court should likewise allow these claims to go forward.
Ms. Schutt, may I follow up on that? We review de novo, which means we look at these facts and arguments anew, correct?
Correct.
So why does it matter what the trial court did if we're the decision maker? Why do we care what the trial court did?
I think it's important because if the trial court, if this court concludes the trial court properly reviewed it under 12b1, which we submit is not correct, then this court has to give more deference to the trial court's decision. That's the opinion of the appellee. Our position is it should be reviewed under 12b5. It wasn't, and this court does not have to give the same deference to what the trial court decided here, and we would urge you to find that these claims have been specifically alleged.
And Ms. Schutt, I would like to move on, because of your limited time, to the willful and wanton conduct on the substantive piece. And let me start with the other defendants, not Giordano.
Mm-hmm.
What evidence did you put on, or did you plead even, that they purposefully disregarded a risk to the players?
Your Honor, with respect to each of those other individual administrators, there are specific allegations set forth as to each individual, as to what their responsibility and duty was, and to how they willfully and wantonly showed a conscious disregard for the safety of student athletes, including Alex Terranova. And again, if you look at some of the case law we've cited in our brief, specifically the Davis versus Paulino case, in that case, the panel of this court found it sufficient that the pro se plaintiff in that case merely alleged that the sheriff there failed to prevent the wrongful acts of his deputies when he had a duty to do so, and that was sufficient to allow those claims to proceed.
With regard to the other defendants, when I read through it, it looks like negligent supervision, but that won't get you over the hurdles. So what do you have beyond negligent supervision? I'm not talking about Giordano yet. I will in a second. But what did you plead beyond something that looks like negligent supervision?
Again, with regard to each of those defendants, we allege specific duties that they had to, depending on whether it was the athletic director or the principal or the superintendent, specific duties spelled out either in statute or within the school policies themselves, to make sure that the conditions that athletes were playing under were safe, and that given specifically the very dangerous nature of this pickoff drill, which contrary to what the trial court suggested, did not in any way mimic the typical circumstances of a baseball game where you have a single baseball being thrown to a pitcher on a mound, that under the circumstances, these administrators consciously disregarded the safety of the student athletes by failing to ensure that they were safe.
Well, I wasn't even aware that they were aware that that drill existed.
But that's our point. They should have been aware.
But isn't that just negligence? I mean, willful and wanton is a very high standard. And you're alleging, you know, things like defendant Peters, the school athletic director, knew or originally should have known of the dangerous practices. Well, do you have any facts, or is there any specific allegation? You pled conclusions, but is there any specific factual allegation that any of these supervisory defendants, if you will, actually knew this drill was happening, that anybody was even on the field, that this young man was hurt? Do you have any allegations of any of that?
I believe our allegations do suggest that there were knowledge and that they knew of these things going on or should have known.
Well, you say knew or should have known. Have you? That's a conclusion. Have you pled facts?
Well, I believe we have under the 12b-5 standard, whether there is any inference of willful and wanton conduct. It's not, conclusory allegations are merely, these defendants have been named and they acted willfully and wantonly. We've provided specific contexts for each of those individuals as to how they acted willfully and wantonly under the circumstances. Again, that's all that's required to survive under Rule 12b-5 standard, looking at it from the standpoint of the light most favorable to the plaintiff, that these are claims that should be allowed to proceed to discovery and the determination on their merits.
So, Ms. Shutt, let's switch gears to the coach, Giordano. The Moody case seems to instruct that we should be looking for an inference of an element of evil. Do we have anything like that with the coach?
Your Honor, I think if you look at the other cases, it's not described to such an extent of evil. I think it's more a matter of they had knowledge that there was a high likelihood of danger and they disregarded it. It was a conscious disregard of that knowledge of danger. Again, if you look at the City of Lakewood versus Brace case, as well as some of the other decisions, for instance, in the Peterson versus Arapahoe County Sheriff's case, where there was an allegation that the defendant sheriff or deputy had spilled coffee on the floor with the intent that someone slip on it and fall. I don't know if you classify that as evil, but it was certainly a conscious disregard for the safety of the inmates. Likewise here.
Well, the intent in that case, as you just pointed out, is that somebody would slip on it and fall. Do we have something similar here?
I think, given the fact that the coach had concussion training 7 days before this and was putting three players on the mound with balls being thrown at high speed from different directions at their unprotected heads, is enough of an inference of willful and wanton conduct that a jury should be allowed to decide whether or not it was indeed willful and wanton.
Let me ask you about that, Ms. Shutt. I know you want to reserve some time. You make allegations that the coach disregarded his concussion training. How did that cause any injury? You haven't pled anything that said the young man's condition was aggravated after this. I mean, he was already hit by the time the coach didn't do anything.
I disagree respectfully, Your Honor. We have alleged that he was hit again on two occasions, and what we know on concussive injuries is they get compounded with each injury. The concussion protocol training, it's not just a matter of him having orchestrated this drill. It was the fact that he did not then take Mr. Terranova out of play and follow the proper protocol to have him both assessed and refrain from continuing to play. What we know about concussions is that a player will continue to sustain aggregated injuries when they continue to participate in activity after they've sustained a concussion, and that's what's been alleged in our complaint. While I'd like to still reserve a minute for rebuttal, I would just briefly address the second part of our contentions here, and that is that the court also erred in finding that this case did not fall into the waiver of immunity for a public condition or a dangerous condition of a public facility or the use thereof. And I think that's the linchpin, is that the trial court glossed over the fact that the statute specifically has language in it defining a dangerous condition to include its use. The trial court said that it's to expand condition to include the use of a public facility would improperly expand the intent of the waiver under the CGA, but it's specific language in the statute. And again, as our Supreme Court made clear in the Bertrand case, because the CGIA is in derogation of common law, its immunity provisions are to be strictly construed, and its waiver provisions are to be broadly construed. And the court must do so in this case. And honestly, in taking a look at the case law, it's hard to reconcile some of these decisions with which have reviewed and addressed the issue of what constitutes a dangerous condition in these circumstances. I think, though, if you look at the cases of Longbottom and Hendricks and Walton v. State, those are the cases which we've cited in our brief and are most analogous to the cases that we have here. The cases that the trial court relied upon, namely Sanchez and Douglas, rely on Jenks, which is a decision which has been reversed in part by the Supreme Court in Bertrand, and also has been limited to its very extreme and compelling facts involving a shooting at a courthouse. So with that, I will reserve what little time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Keith Gilman. I represent the defendants' appellants in this case. So the defendants, just being the party who's been sued in the underlying case, the facts you've heard a little bit about, I represent the defendants. Let me just give you a brief explanation for who they are and what their role was here. You already heard a little bit about that. One of the defendants I represent is Adams 12 Five Star Schools. That's a school district that has been sued as a school district. So the attorney has specifically sued the district seeking compensation for these injuries. They also sued five individuals in the language of law as individuals. So they sued the assistant principal at Legacy High School, who also served as the athletic director. They sued the principal of Legacy High School. They sued the baseball, varsity baseball coach, Tyrone Giordano. They sued the district-wide athletic director, and they sued the district superintendent. As typically happens in these cases, in these types of cases, I represent each one of those defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Gilman.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Keith Gilman, registration number 37769, on behalf of Adams 12 Five Star Schools and each of the five individually named defendants. The fundamental question presented by this appeal is this: do these facts fit? Do the facts as alleged by the Terranovas fit the attempted exceptions or waivers of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act? Or, as the district court recognized, is this, at its bottom, an accidental and unfortunate baseball injury that is being called and alleged to have been more than that, not because the facts support it, but because the pleading requirements of the CGIA mandate it? So let's talk about those issues. I want to dive right into the willful and wanton issue. The question, it doesn't sound like there's much disagreement about what the question before this panel is. Do these specific factual allegations in the amended complaint amount to or give rise to a reasonable inference of wanton and willful misconduct as a matter of law? And did that wanton and willful misconduct cause Alex Terranova's injuries? Let's take those allegations and analyze how they stack up compared to recent case law. The Gray decision was cited. I think that's a perfect place to start and perhaps end the analysis. Because in Gray, we have not just an example of what types of allegations pass muster, but also what allegations are insufficient. So in Gray, as you know, we have a doctor. The allegations were good enough against the doctor. And we have a technician. The allegations did not suffice against the technician. So let's take a look at that and compare them to what we have here. Briefly, the allegations against the doctor in Gray. He provided insufficient staff. He knew that the staffing was insufficient because of previous near misses, is what they were termed in the opinion. Previous occasions where patients had been placed at risk by these inadequate staffing levels. We also see in the complaint in Gray that he knew of that inadequacy because he had discussed these near misses on specific occasions with members of the staff. And then what we see is the allegation in Gray against the doctor is that in and around and after the fact, he misrepresented important facts. He lied, in other words, about the inadequate staffing levels and the reasons therefore. And the allegation is in Gray is that he did that because he wanted to increase the profit margin for the hospital. So when we look at the malevolent motive, the element of evil that runs through this line of case laws, the thing that makes this more than simple negligence, that's what was found to be sufficient in Gray versus the University of Colorado Hospital.
Mr. Goldman, can you, looking at the facts that we have here, why isn't the assertion against Mr. Giordano that he knew about concussive injuries, had taken a course about a week before Alex's first injury, and therefore he knew about concussive injuries, and yet he didn't remove Alex from play. Why isn't that sufficient fact to meet the standard that you just talked about?
And if I may add to that, the facts, and he runs a drill that seemed just on its face to be patently dangerous. He's got three pitchers on the mound, each throwing to a different base, and the ball's coming back at him. So with the facts Judge Casebolt said in that one, why doesn't that get you at least an inference?
Sure. So two things to address the first question first. First of all, there is no allegation and no facts to support the allegation that Mr. Giordano was trying to do anything other than conduct a baseball tryout on March 3rd and a baseball practice on March 30th. There's no allegation that he's out to get a student in particular. There's nothing that's analogous to this kind of malevolent-sounding profit motive that we see as alleged against the doctor in Gray.
But the doctor wasn't out to get the patient in Gray either, was he?
No, but he was out to disregard the risk to the patient so that the hospital could make more money. And that, I contend, is the distinction. There is a state actor trying to do something other than just do his job and care for patients.
Let me test the scope a little bit. What if the motivation was to not get a varsity baseball player diagnosed with a concussion? Would that be sufficient?
Perhaps, although the concern I have is one that's already been expressed, and this will address both the questions. We still have the causation problem. So on March 3rd, what happens is he's beamed in the head by a pitch while he's batting. The injury is complete at that point in time. If there had been an allegation that at some point after the fact, Mr. Terranova continued to experience an exacerbation of symptoms that could have been medically treated had he been diagnosed on the day, or if there was an allegation that Mr. Terranova, if he were immediately removed from play, would have been... Let me put it this way. If Mr. Terranova had been somehow unable to defend himself because of that earlier head injury, if there had been some nexus between the failure to diagnose a concussion and injury to Alex Terranova, perhaps that would come closer. But again, we have to keep in mind the only allegation of manifestation of this concussion symptom on March 3rd is he appeared dazed. Nothing about whether he was unable to attend classes in the 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, and nothing about being unable to recall facts, being unable to function in a classroom or baseball setting for nearly 4 weeks until the next injury. So, the returning to the issue of this drill, let's compare the alleged dangerousness of the drill to the facts as alleged against the doctor in Gray. The thing we don't have here that we had in Gray were specific allegations of previous near misses or previous instances where those patients were placed at risk because of the policy. We have no allegation of a prior injury from this drill, no allegation of any complaints about the conduct of this drill. And in fact, the opposite is the inference that can be drawn from this, from these allegations, because the allegation is that this drill had been orchestrated the same way by Coach Giordano in the past. So taking those facts as alleged together, the fair inference and the reasonable inference to draw is this drill had been conducted before with no allegation of injury. So we don't have the near misses, and we don't have the risk of injury as acutely as we do in Gray. The other reason why I think Gray is a useful opinion is because you have the allegations against the technician. I want to move on to the dangerous condition exception, but let me just speak to that briefly, because I think when you look at what the technician was doing and why that was insufficient, is that the technician was really just doing his job. He didn't set policy. He didn't set staffing levels. He didn't make decisions from on high. He just went about doing his job as a technician. That was not enough to cross the threshold into wanton and willful conduct. That was, at most, negligence and inadequate.
Can I ask you about the Davis case? How do
Yes.
you reconcile the facts of the Davis case with this case? Because in that situation, you had a prisoner who was asserting that a Department of Corrections guard had spilled coffee or juice and intentionally did not clean it up. And the court held there that that was sufficiently alleged a willful and wanton act that survived a motion to dismiss.
Sure. So a couple reasons. So Davis versus Paulino was talked about. The allegations there were we have an intentional spill of coffee and juice, an intentional, the reason why that was done was so that someone would be put at risk of injury. We have active, purposeful behavior with no other discernible purpose, as alleged, other than causing injury. Here, so two things distinguish this case here. What we have is Coach Giordano is trying to go about coaching a baseball team. The pro-social utility of Coach Giordano's behavior is present, whereas we have someone who's spilling coffee and juice for no good reason other than to injure someone. The other distinction between Davis and the Terranova's allegations, of course, is it gets back to the causation problem. Coach Giordano didn't throw that baseball. He didn't miss that baseball. He's not the one who, to put it in the Davis context, spilled the coffee with the malevolent motive. So Davis, while, and I think the court recognized this in the opinion, the allegations, there was enough facts and enough allegations in that complaint to at least allow it to proceed until some discovery could be taken, until an affidavit could be written that might figure out, is that really what happened there? Or is there a more innocent and better explanation? But at least at the pleading stage, that was sufficient. And I think that's consistent with case law on this issue. The dangerous condition allegation. Let me turn to that if
Mr.
I can.
Stover, can I interrupt you? I know you want to talk about that. I just don't want you to run out of time. I have an issue with, or a question about the attorney fees. So if I can ask you to jump over this for a minute. And it really goes to the fee issue with respect to Coach Giordano. You're arguing here that, in effect, this is a 12B dismissal and the policy of 12B requires fees. And I'm just, I guess I'll put it out there, I'm really concerned how that squares with the statute. You have to have a complete dismissal under 12B, and as I understand it, there are two allegations here against Coach Giordano. One was willful and wanton, and one was he was an independent contractor.
Right.
The court refused to dismiss the case under 12B, the second piece, the independent contractor piece. The court said, I'm going to let you take discovery. At that point, I gather some discovery happened.
Correct.
And then the plaintiffs voluntarily withdraw that claim. Why isn't that akin to a concession of a summary judgment motion and not a concession of a 12B quite a controversy here. How could we say there was a complete dismissal under 12B as to Coach Judge Arnold? In fact, the court refused to dismiss under 12B the whole case.
I believe the answer to that lies in the court's procedure. What the court said was, I'm not going to rule on the independent contractor issue right now. I will schedule a Trinity hearing if that's what the parties want. And if in anticipation of that Trinity hearing, the parties want to engage in limited Trinity-type discovery, they can do that. But as the court knows, a Trinity hearing is to resolve the Rule 12B1 issue. So, in anticipation and before that Rule 12B hearing was held pursuant to Trinity, the Terra Novas voluntarily dismissed their allegation. But that was a dismissal in light of and in response to our motion to dismiss and the court's offer of a Trinity hearing. So before we could even finally resolve the issue there, the question, I don't think their voluntarily dismissal of one part of one claim can... let me take two parts of that. I don't think it can entirely extinguish the attorney's fees against Coach Giordano for the reasons stated, but that also does not affect the fact that pursuant to Stauffer versus Stegeman and Smith versus Town of Snowmass Village, each of the other defendants at that point in time had the case entirely dismissed against them. And so at least each of those other defendants are entitled to their attorney's fees. And if this court thinks the proper course is to then, on remand, have the court make further findings about what attorney's fees were incurred as it relates to the litigation of the motion to dismiss as to each of those other defendants, I think that may be an appropriate course to take. But to throw out the attorney's fees altogether is not supported by the statute. The dangerous condition of the baseball mound. I really think one question analytically gets to the heart of whether this is an actionable dangerous condition, and that's this. Did the baseball mound cause his injury, or was the mound quite literally just a hill of dirt he happened to be standing on when he was struck by a baseball? And that is the distinction that can be drawn between the cases principally relied on by the Terra Novas, Hendricks, Walton, Longbottom, and these allegations. Setting aside the intricacies of those cases, I don't think we have to go any further than this. In each of those cases, there is no dispute, and it was obvious, that the allegedly dangerous condition caused the injury complained of. Whether it's the unpadded gymnasium wall that the student slides into and fractures his or her leg in Hendricks, whether it's the jointer machine that the student cuts his hand on in Longbottom, or whether it's the slippery floor with the ladder on top of it while they're doing maintenance work in Walton. The correlation between the dangerous condition and the injury is clear. Here, the injury was caused by a thrown baseball, and he just happened to be standing in or near the mound when he was injured. That's not an actual dangerous condition in light of a long line of cases starting with Jinx. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, just with regard to the willful and wanton claim, there was some suggestion of Moody requiring an element of evil, but in the Gray case, which we focused on, the court framed the issue, relying on Moody, as the following. There must be some reasonable inference the employee was consciously aware that their acts or omissions create danger or risk to the safety of others, and then they then act or fail to act without regard to the danger or risk. There has definitely been sufficient allegations to support that here. In Moody, the court distinguished that from the situation for the state trooper there, where he had a choice between two logical alternatives. That is not what we had here. There was no logic in what was done with regard to this drill and the reaction afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted.